Hey y'all, it's Jason here. Just wanted to give you a quick warning that today's bonus episode does contain references to PTSD symptoms and substance abuse, and it may not be suitable for all listeners, and I just thought it was fair to give everybody a warning. All right, let's get into the episode. I'm Jason Kander, and this is Majority 54, the podcast that helps the 54% of us who did not vote for Donald Trump talk to those of us who did about the most divisive issues in our country. Today's episode is a little bit different, and we're excited about it. So for a little while, Ravi and I and the team at Wonder have been talking about the possibility of doing a few bonus episodes where we talk to people who we think are just really interesting folks who can give us insight on the mission of this podcast, which is helping you talk to people in your life who might be more conservative, who you want to bring around. And we just have this sort of stable of people that we've been wanting to talk to, but it doesn't really fit the podcast's usual format of going through the news of the week. And so we're going to try that right here. And we're starting with Chris Taylor. And I'm going to bring Chris in a minute, but first I want to introduce you to him a bit. I'll just tell you how I came to know of him. I had seen him come across my feed earlier this year a couple of times. I saw a combat veteran who was running for Congress. I could see that his point of view was coming from, you know, kind of the right side of the Republican Party, that he was in a primary. And I remember it standing out to me because his personal story and mine had something in common, which is he had recovered from post-traumatic stress. And in his case, he also had recovered from substance abuse. And he was, I think, 6 years sober. And I remember being intrigued by that, but not really digging much deeper. And then a few months later, I remember seeing the news that he had relapsed, that he had overdosed, that he was getting out of the race. And without knowing anything more, I just, in order to be supportive, I think I tweeted something about the idea that there's no political affiliation on dog tags. And I wanted to be supportive. And I didn't think much of it. And then sometime later, I got this email, which I'll share with y'all. This email, and it's from Chris, and it says, "I'm the veteran who overdosed while running for Congress in Arizona. I wanted to reach out and, one, thank you again for your support during that difficult time. Two, I'd love to come on your amazing podcast and join the conversation. I'm ready to tell my story about how compromising my conscience and values to appease and court Republican primary voters," and he has in parentheses, "Trump cultists, nearly killed me. I've always been a middle-of-the-road guy, a moderate John McCain, Mitt Romney, Jeff Flake kind of Republican. I have never supported Trump one ounce. I was running for Congress to fight for the soul of my party. So because my motives were pure, I felt like it would be okay to equivocate on some things and infiltrate the cult and remind those people what real leadership looks like. Obviously, it didn't work out. What I heard, saw, and experienced on a daily basis on the campaign trail was so appalling and stressful that it really contributed to my relapse and recurrence of my combat PTSD. After this experience, I'm in a better place mentally and emotionally than I've ever been. I've left the Republican Party for good. I'm actually thinking about becoming a Democrat. Anyway, I'd love to join you and be a guest to talk about all this. Great podcast, brother. Thanks for your example." Obviously, this struck me, meant a lot to me, and Ravi and I have been excited to have this conversation. So, Chris, man, thanks for your courage and for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's, I remember emailing you. I don't remember exactly what I said, but I feel that even more now today than I did a couple months ago when I said that to you.
Chris, I would love to hear, just before we go on, just a little bit about your service. So before you ran for office, where and when did you serve, and why did you jump in?
I served in the U.S. Army Special Operations Community as a psychological warfare specialist, and I deployed to Afghanistan twice during the height of that war, 2009 and 2010. My job was, I had a small team attached to an ODA, a Green Beret team. We were, conducting unconventional warfare, psychological warfare to influence the population there to support the democratically elected government of Afghanistan. And, I saw a lot of combat, had a lot of close calls, a lot of friends that were killed. And when I came home and I decided not to reenlist because I was going to have to go right back for a third tour, everything kind of slowed down. And I was, all of those experiences kind of rushed back to me, and I hadn't processed them before because I was in a situation where I couldn't process them. And then I had an injury from a combat injury, a back injury. And, I was prescribed opioid medication, and I quickly self-medicated my post-traumatic stress symptoms with that. And then I got out and went to Got some help from the VA after kind of a struggle. I was put on the secret waiting list at the Phoenix VA. That was a big scandal that came out in 2014. It took 9 months before I could even see a mental health provider at the VA. But when I finally did get that help, I decided, I changed my life. I met my wife and we started a family and started a career of service to my community as a firefighter, a city council member, had a nonprofit that was helping other veterans and other people suffering from addiction. And then, I was approached by people in the Republican Party to run for the congressional seat. And so I really wanted to restore the soul of the party, but also to stop the hyper-partisanship that we see that's just destroying everything. And that's what I did. And then obviously, we could talk about what happened after that, but.
So you were PSYOPs, and I didn't know that until just now. I knew you were special ops. I didn't know you were the PSYOP component of it. For folks listening, that is really fascinating and really dangerous work. I spent some time working with the PSYOP team in Afghanistan. I was out of Kabul. I went with them to Jalalabad, and I can remember those guys just having to give people an example. Like, those guys had a rule where they were one of the few elements, along with some of us in the intel world, but really, really especially them, who were allowed to quote unquote self-protect, which for those listening, it's important to understand that meant like, hey, go wherever you want. We've trained you up to the point where you and your small team go wherever you want in your street clothes, going by first names only, and you can self-protect. You don't need anybody else there to watch out for you. I was not doctrinally told that. It kind of sort of happened for me anyway in my tour, but like PSYOP is basically so HUA that they're like, these guys self-protect. And that's, just for context, that's what Chris did.
Yeah, well, maybe one other question, and share as much as you want, is just how did you hurt yourself out there?
So my personal interpreter, an Afghan national, was shot right in front of me in a firefight, and I started to treat his wound, and I had to move him to safety. And I had already been exhausted that day, and I picked him up and moved a couple meters, and he was so, all of his gear so heavy, I fell and ruptured a disc in my back. And it was excruciating pain that I had to deal with. And then when I came home, there was some damage, and the army prescribed me that opioid pain medication.
And how quickly did you know that you needed to seek mental health support when you got back to the United States?
It was pretty quickly. When I got home to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, everything was just different. I was angry when I never was angry before. I was having nightmares. I was starting to just go downhill a little bit. And my superiors who had my back said, hey, need to get some help. And so I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress at Fort Bragg when I was still on active duty. And that kind of, my dad was a Vietnam veteran, and he dealt with a little bit of a hard transition when he came home. And so he came and picked me up at Fort Bragg after I was honorably discharged, and we drove home to Arizona. It was really, we drove home in 24 hours. We didn't stop. And that next Monday, I was at the Phoenix VA trying to get an appointment.
Were you on a medical discharge?
So I was, have a 80%.
Like a medically retired?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason I ask is, that's a pretty abrupt end to your career, which is almost like another trauma in and of itself.
It was, being a part of the team and being a, just as a young guy, having such a amazing a responsibility on you. And, it wasn't all bad. Of course, there was lots of bad parts about it. But just when I came home, realizing that, I'll never do something as cool as I was involved in, and the camaraderie and everything, which is why I, became a firefighter and stuff like that. But you never get that adrenaline and that that space where you're it's life and death, and you're operating at such a high level. It's just that's a big part that I think people don't realize. It's not all just post-traumatic stress. It's transitioning to you know, what you're going to do. And after having all that responsibility and coming home and basically being homeless and jobless, because how do you tell an employer, how do you translate your skills in a way that they understand? You know, it's really difficult.
It's hard for people who have never done it to understand that the difference between, like, I think people think, well, you go from soldier to veteran, and that's not really how it works. Because it's not a job, it's who you are. You look in the mirror and you're a soldier, right? And everything you do, everything you think about, you're a soldier. Like for me, you know, I was a reservist, so technically I was a part-time soldier, but to me, like, I was a soldier who also did some legal work and some political work. Like, that's what I was. And then when I had my last drill weekend, like, it was a long time before I even thought of myself as a veteran. And so it's a really, that's why I asked. I mean, that is a, that in and of itself is an abrupt transition to make in your personal identity. And I figured that is why you became a firefighter, and it's why you wanted to go into public service.
And do you mind if we just, like, if you just mind filling in that little detail, which is you're a firefighter and you're getting approached and talking to people in the GOP. I'd love to hear more just about what you believed at the time, both, like, what were your views, political views, and what you thought campaigning would be like before we get to maybe when you're on the trail, for example.
Yeah. So, you know, in 2016, I was elected as a city council member of a small community that I've grown up in. You know, I had some media stories about, you know, my struggles with addiction and stuff, because that was a big part of my, what I was. I didn't hide anything. And I think that was kind of the appeal. It was people saw me as inspiration, I guess. And so I was approached by some people in the Republican Party that, you know, had been involved in congressional campaigns in that district. The first district of Arizona is a crazy district. That's one of the largest land-wise in the whole United States and one of the most diverse. And President Trump won it by 1%, but the Congress seat is held by a Democrat. And so, you know, they felt that it was a seat that they could pick up. I had lots of apprehensions about it, just the way that the Republican Party was shifting. And, you know, I was a very moderate Republican. And because of my history with criminal justice and, you know, things like that, I was in direct opposition to a lot of the things that the Republican Party stand for. But with standard bearers like Mitt Romney and George H.W. Bush and in Arizona, Jeff Flake and John McCain, that's who I wanted to be like. And that's who I modeled my public service after. And when I jumped in, I knew that I was going to have to stay quiet about some things. And I knew that I would have to equivocate. I never did anything really, but people would say, because of your history in the military, you remind us of a young John McCain. And because of your religion, you remind us of a young Jeff Flake. Are you going to be a traitor to your country like them? And I mean,
and this is like people on the trail, like, yeah, regular voters.
Regular voters.
Yeah.
What'd you say?
So that was the hardest part for me, because, you know, people believe what President Trump says about John McCain, and that, you know, the conspiracy theories about him being a traitor in Vietnam. And these people have no idea what he went through and what he sacrificed and the kind of man that he was. And every part of me wanted to say, yes, I'm going to be exactly like John McCain and Jeff Flake. I'm going to be an independent thinker. I'm not going to blindly follow anybody. But I knew I couldn't say that. And so I would say things like, you know, well, they're, you know, anyone who spends a lot of time in Washington can get jaded. And, you know, I think I just said things like that, which I didn't believe, but I had to walk that line. And little by little, doing things like that really compromised my conscience and what I stood for. And it became more vile and more, you know, racist stuff and more, you know, just the things we see. I mean, it was hard for me to stay quiet, but I knew I couldn't win a Republican primary by speaking my mind, basically.
And what are some of those vile, like, you talk about how it got even more vile. What are some of the things that listeners who aren't completely familiar with what it's like on the campaign trail for a Republican in Arizona, What are some things that were
pretty... Democrat in Missouri sometimes,
or a Democrat in Missouri.
I bet
yeah, both
heard
of you,
some of the
by
same
the way.
Stuff.
Yeah. So both of you actually, what are some things that are common? Like, I think less important is probably the one-off thing that you see, but what are some things that you saw continually that started to wear you down?
Well, you know, being in Arizona and, you know, less than 80 miles from the border, you know, of course we deal with a lot of illegal immigration and stuff like that. And I underestimated, I guess, the underlying racism that exists amongst the base of the Republican Party. I think that for a long time we kind of kept that at bay. We kind of it was on the fringe, but it was, I saw it every day, and it was not it was very hard to deal with
when that happens, because I've been there. It just takes your breath away when somebody does it right to your face. Like I can remember, I mean, it happened many times for me. Usually for me, the context was I'd be in a rural part of Missouri shaking hands in a diner or something. And I'd identify myself and they'd ask what party. I'd say I'm a Democrat. And then somebody would just say something just horribly racist about President Obama. Or, so that was one way. And that would always take my breath away. And then I would just like, you know, in my case, I'd reply to him, say I didn't agree, but move on. But then sometimes there was a middle ground that I didn't know what to do with all the time, which was somebody would say like, well, I used to be a Democrat, but I'm not anymore. I can't support this president. And I'd say, well, how come? And then this was always the key phrase. They'd say personal reasons. And I always thought, because personally, you're racist as hell, right? I mean, but it just takes your breath away. Like, you're just like, holy crap. I can't believe that just happened. Which, by the way, like I will say, like, as a white guy, like, it also has given me an insight into that happened to me so rarely that it just made me realize like people who aren't white are walking around just having that sort of interaction a lot more often. And yeah, and it's jarring. But anyway,
I was going to ask if is Prescott, I think Prescott used to be part of that district, but it's not anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's not anymore. They drew it kind of weird, but that's, I believe, Congressman Gosar's district.
Yeah, well, quick story on Prescott. I was out there 2 years ago with a bunch of members of my team, and I was with a staff member of mine who's Dominican. And for folks who are just listening and don't know about my background, I'm brown. I think I could be mistaken as a lot of different types of ethnicities. And because I was in Prescott and because I was with one of my staff members who is Dominican, I think people there, not a very diverse town, but people there thought I was probably Mexican. And I don't think I've ever been treated quite like that before. I was surprised. I didn't have a lot of experience in Arizona, and we were at a bar one night. It was just me and Chris was his name, our staff member. And we were the only brown people in the whole bar. There was a band playing, and they had Confederate flag, like belt buckles and things like that. And then at one point they stopped playing music, looked at us, pointed at us, and said, "This one goes out to Sheriff Joe," and everybody just looked at us and applauded.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that was Prescott.
So that gives people a pretty good idea of kind of the electorate that Chris was dealing with in the Republican primary there, I think.
And so at what point, walk us through, how long are you on the campaign trail before you actually start pondering taking some kind of action here? Or did you even consciously decide to take action?
Chris, is the answer, it was sort of effectuated by the overdose, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was on the campaign trail for over 8 months. I was by every measure the front runner in that primary. And, you know, my campaign staff started to get expanded, and the pressure to keep paying them and you know, having to sell myself and to raise the money and everything. And you know, the district I mentioned was so large that I was away from my young family way more than I thought I was going to have to be. And you know, the pressure and everything really was hard. But what happened really for me was, you know, I had got complacent about my recovery and my what the bedrock of my successes and in with PTSD and with addiction. And you know, the things I was trying to accomplish were really good, but I lost focus and I thought, because my life was so different from when I was suffering from addiction and stuff like that, that I thought that I had beat it completely. And it's human nature to think that, you know, you triumph over something and it's over. But so it really blindsided me, and it was a kind of a perfect storm of things. But I had a very weak moment and I relapsed. And then, you know,
Well, before you talk about what happened next, I'm curious, just as a fellow combat vet with PTSD, I'm guessing that prior to your relapse, I'm guessing you started to have a recurrence of symptoms of post-traumatic stress, like hypervigilance, nightmares, right?
Yeah.
And what I completely relate to here is that feeling of forgetting that it is a perishable thing, that it's work and there's maintenance you got to do, right? It's, you know, I always compare post-traumatic stress to like a physical injury, and that like if you had a really bad knee injury that you've recovered from, and then one day you just decided, I'm going to run as far as I want, and I'm not going to ice my knee afterwards, and I'm going to pretend this never happened. Well, obviously you would re-injure yourself. And so I'm guessing that's what happened, right? It's like, and if you talk about, if you don't mind, some of the symptoms that started to come back that obviously caused you to turn to self-medication.
Yeah, so I mean, you're right on the head. I mean, I know that you understand exactly what I was going through. It is a maintenance thing, and that's a great analogy. And it's like I was running a major marathon without icing my knee, you know,
or drinking water.
Yeah, and staying hydrated. And so I think the depression hit me really hard. The anxiety of you know, the expectations that I had placed on myself and that my community had on me and everything. And then just the pressures. And also it was a major part, you know, I hate to compromise my conscience at all. And I felt, and that weighed on me every day, it kind of grew more and more. And so I started to isolate myself. I started to try to stay away. And that's almost impossible as a congressional candidate with the staff and everything. They would be like, what's going on? Why are you, you know? And I was just like, I just need some time. And so I would isolate. I wasn't being honest about my feelings and what I was going through. And
probably with yourself either, right?
Yeah. With myself, with my family, with my staff, with everybody. I completely just withdrew and tried to, you know, I did all the wrong things. And so then I started to have recurring nightmares, and then it was, I couldn't sleep. And then, you know, it started to take a toll on me. And really what it comes down to me, my addiction started, with opioid medication for physical pain. And I realized that it masked my emotional pain. And really when I relapsed without even thinking about it, this is what I've learned later in therapy, is that I just wanted to numb that pain again, even though I knew that that's not the answer. And that's actually going to become more of the problem. You know, I had a weak moment, and then I was stuck in a situation where, okay, I can't tell anybody that I'm struggling like this. I can't tell anybody that I've relapsed, because, you know, everybody, their careers and their paychecks and their, and not only that, but my supporters, you know, they depend on me. And a lot of people that I helped through my nonprofit that I was continuing to help, as that guiding light for their struggles. I mean, if I come out and say that I am failing or that I, relapsed, you know, what does that mean for them? And that was probably too much of a burden that I placed on myself, but that contributed. And then so for a couple more weeks, I tried to hide it. And obviously with heroin and stuff like that, you hear the term addiction is a progressive disease. And I never knew what that meant, because I had been clean for 6 years. When I relapsed and used only a couple times, my addiction was right back to where I was 6 years before. And the bottom, I fell farther, faster than I ever thought possible. It's like my addiction was just dormant, waiting for me to mess up, and it was right back. And so thankfully it came to a head that night. I overdosed. I say that, it's hard to say that, but now where I am now and what happened and the personal growth that I've had with my family and myself, if that wouldn't have happened, who knows what I'd be doing now. I mean, I definitely wouldn't be a good candidate. I probably wouldn't have won, and I, you know, whatever, but I'm glad it happened, because when it happened and when it went so public, I knew that there was such a relief that I could just say, this is what happened, and there's no more hiding it. And I'm going to get the help that I need, and I'm going to come back even stronger.
Yeah, man, there's so much shame that just is inherent to post-traumatic stress and to trauma, right? It's just, there's so much shame already that isn't, it's not real. It's not earned, but it's there, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you put any sort of holding things back from the world on top of that, when you remove that, that does feel good. And yeah, I mean, I totally get like that you're glad the way it came out, because maybe you would have won, and then maybe you'd have spent all your time being told, well, you can't get a primary. You've got to continue this. You're our new guy. You got to keep this up. And it would not have ended well. And so I'm glad you made, let me ask, were there people even after that who were encouraging you, or was there any discussion of like, hey, well, why don't we just not talk about this? Or, you know, like, let's just keep going. I imagine there were.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I live in a small town, and I have close relationships with the media here. I definitely could have buried that and, you know, secretly and quietly got some help and then got back on the campaign trail. But I knew that that's not the way I wanted to handle it. Anything that's hidden, you know, you can't heal. And so I actually put out a press release before anybody knew. And I just said, look, this is what happened, and I'm not going to let this shame stand in the way of me overcoming this and taking responsibility and everything else. And that, surprisingly, is what became the story. All of the producers and stuff from CNN and New York Times and all over, you know, I expected it to be like, oh, this Trump-supporting congressional candidate is a heroin addict and all this. But that's not what it was at all. And it was so overwhelming, the positive comments and stuff. I had my personal cell phone on my website. And after that story broke that day, I got hundreds of voicemails and calls and comments, and 99% of them were positive. And it was amazing. And that gave me such hope. And the one reason why I realized that, you know, the Republican Party is just, I can't be a part of it, is at least 80 to 90% of those voicemails would be prefaced with, hey, you know, I can't agree with your politics. I'm a Democrat, or I'm whatever, but I care about you as a human being. And you know, I can feel your pain, and thank you for the way you've handled it. And that was kind of the last straw for me, because, yeah, I did get some support from the Republican Party and people who've known me, but the overwhelming majority of people were independent, or you know, they would always say because they thought that I was a MAGA Trump supporter, and that wasn't me at all, but yeah.
Well, you hadn't disavowed any of that at that point, and so all that much more notable that they're reaching out. So before we get into sort of discussion of like politics right now and your thoughts, because I'm eager to do that, how are you doing? What is your life like right now, and how are you?
So, you know, I just celebrated 8 months in recovery, and
congratulations.
I can honestly say that it's more solid and more meaningful than this almost 7 years I had before, you know, because I learned so much when I relapsed. I took the time to really dissect everything about me. And my family has been amazing, my wife and my children. You know, with the pandemic, right when I came back from treatment is when everything got shut down. And so we kind of took that time to just reconnect as a family. And I didn't have any pressures or anything like that. And the amount of growth we've had has been amazing. And, you know, I've decided to finish my degree in public relations, and I'm still doing a lot in my small community, especially around addiction and overdose awareness and stuff like that. And so that keeps me busy, but really my focus is just being a father and being a husband. If there's something in the future as far as politics, you know, I don't want to close that door at all. But like I said, I don't see any path forward in the Republican Party at all.
Well, and isn't it amazing what a difference it makes when you're enjoying your life in the present moment, how much less you think about what you might do in the future?
Yeah, it's crazy. I get the question a lot, but it's really, you know, I've learned that I have to be present in the moment, in the day. And it's kind of a cliche, but it's so important to just focus, you know, make good goals and stuff to achieve, but you really have to stay focused on what's important. And that's what I'm doing. And so whatever comes will happen. It'll supposed to happen, you know?
Yeah. Right after my announcement, Max Cleland, who's a former VA secretary, called me and we had a great conversation. And one of the things he said was, he suffered from PTS. And one of the things he said to me was, Jason, your job is to find one moment of fucking joy every day. Cause if you do that, you fucking win. and I think about that a lot. Yeah, beyond the idea of whether or not ideologically you feel welcome in one party or another, I want to make sure anybody listening to this has a good idea of whether or not, and I suspect I know the answer, whether or not you feel like from a mental health perspective or from a moral injury perspective or anything like that, like you are in any way held back in your future or in any way not capable of trying those things.
No, I mean, absolutely not. I think with the right your routine and the right plan and keeping my treatment and things that I need to do, my maintenance as priority, it doesn't hold me back at all. Actually, it's made me a stronger person, a better man, somebody who understands a lot more and can empathize with people and relate to people. You know, I wouldn't change my experiences for anything because it's made me who I am. And so, you know, as long as I'm doing what I need to do and I'm taking care of myself and my family, number one, nothing's going to hold me back and nothing would hold any veteran or otherwise a non-veteran that's dealing with PTS. You know, you can live a healthy, happy life and be very productive.
All right. Well, let's talk about the politics a bit. Ravi, go ahead, because yeah. I'm all into this PTS conversation. So
yeah, well, I just want to thank you both for letting me be a fly on the wall for this, because I'm learning a lot. My brother fought in Afghanistan, and he's now works in the federal corrections system, and you make me wonder whether I need to be asking him better questions about his experience. So the question of, so you've talked a lot about what the sort of personal manifestations of this, and while you're going through, you know, struggling with the addiction and the PTS, you were also going through an experience, an ideological experience. So you were grappling with the fact that you believed things that were, your actions and your beliefs weren't lining up. And so after you leave this campaign, at what point do you do anything public about your views and how were they received?
So, you know, after I came home from treatment and got some on some solid ground, I started a podcast that, you know, is not major or anything, but for my
It could be. Tell everybody about it. Maybe we can make it more major.
It's called Come This Far with Chris Taylor, and it's kind of a shortened version of I didn't come this far to only come this far. And it's kind of a mantra that I've taken on with my family. And so, you know, the podcast is kind of picked up here locally in Arizona and with people who've known me my whole life and stuff. And, you know, I tried to keep it not political because it's really about you know, human struggle and overcoming and redemption and highlighting stories like that. But, you know, the political part of me is just a big part of who I am. So obviously with everything going on, I have to have an avenue to get out my thoughts and my, you know, everything that I'm going through. And so it was a couple months ago, I guess now I came out, you know, the whole thing with the pandemic, I mean, let's get real. You know, this is, it's just unbelievable. I shake my head so many times every day with just the whole mask thing and the disinformation that is spread from the president of the United States. And, you know, so I finally just said, I can't do this. So I made a whole podcast about, how horrible it is and how Joe Biden is, I don't agree with him on everything, but he's a decent, honorable human being that his biggest strength is empathy and being able to relate to people. And he really wants to unite the country. And so I came out and said, I'm voting for Joe Biden and I'm a lifelong Republican. And it's funny because I think that most people supported me still after I overdosed on heroin. And I felt that support. But when I came out against President Trump and endorsed Joe Biden, that's when they jumped off the Chris Taylor train, I guess, you know, and it was crazy. I got a lot of backlash because in my county in Arizona, it's the most rural county, one of the smallest counties. I think President Trump won by like 80% or something in 2016 here. And so there's a lot of people who, you know, they eat that Russian disinformation up like faster than President Trump eats Big Macs, you know, it's crazy. And so I took a lot of flack, but, you know, I felt so good about it. And there's a lot of people who've private messaged me and saying, again, thank you for that, you know, the courage to do that. And we feel the same way. We can't say it, but we're going to vote for Joe Biden.
So have you had conversations with other folks who are sort of in your mold, you know, the people who were, you know, attracted to people like McCain and Romney and, you know, more down the middle, moderate voters? Like, I imagine you've had some of those conversations over the last few months.
Absolutely. I mean, the, you know, I'm part of a group, McCain alum for Biden. I'm a part of the LDS church. There's a huge LDS for Biden. You know, there's a lot of people who are feeling the way I feel. And, you know, just the way that the president attacked John McCain and Jeff Flake turned off a lot of people. I mean, that right there was a big deal here in Arizona. But, you know, with the way that he's handled this pandemic and the way that, you know, I don't even know. There's so many things that people talk to me about, like the Russian bounty thing with soldiers in Afghanistan. I mean, that shook me to my core, you know, to understand that, you know, I was in Afghanistan. And if Vladimir Putin was putting a bounty on my head and my commander in chief didn't have my back, I mean, I can't even imagine that. And President Obama was my commander in chief the whole time that I was in the service. And, you know, I didn't agree with everything he did, but I respected him so much as the commander in chief. And that was one thing. Still today, people are so obsessed with Clinton, Obama. I mean, everything I say about President Trump, their only comeback is, well, what about President Obama? Or they don't even say President Obama, you know, what about Obama? Oh, bummer. And it's like, man, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, the what about sort of line is like, it's a tough one. And we probably need to deal with this more on Majority 54 because it is the most common rejoinder. And so, you know, we don't have enough time today to talk through it more, but you just made a mental note for us to spend some time on the whataboutism. I do want to underline something you said, which is that the LDS community is moving more towards Biden than they typically have for Democrats in the past. And I've been reading a lot about, you know, this is not going to make the difference in Utah, right, because of the numbers. But you see with Flake, Senator Flake, with Senator Romney now saying he didn't vote for President Trump. And there have been some aggregate reporting. But I would love to hear a little bit more just from your personal perspective about what that fault line is for people who are not very familiar with LDS and Arizona in particular, because I don't think people know how big that community is in Arizona and how important it is politically.
Yeah, I mean, Arizona by no means is, you know, on par with Utah, but the second highest number of LDS members are in Arizona. And LDS women in particular have broken for Biden in astronomical numbers. And I think it's going to make the difference in Arizona. I really do, because you know, Biden's up by, I think last time I checked, 3% or something in Arizona, and that constituency is going to break overwhelmingly for Biden. That, you know, that LDS women, suburban women, and you know, it's crazy because, you know, when Romney was the nominee, obviously he had amazing support in the community, but in 2016, Trump out of all of religious groups, out of all of Christian groups, the LDS voted for him at a much less pace than any other Republican nominee. And it's even more so now. Everything that he stands for and everything that he is and says and does is in direct opposition to what our church teaches. And, you know, the leadership of the church, they do not get involved in, you know, candidates and supporting candidates. But it's plain to see, you know, with the immigration, his stances on illegal immigration, the Muslim ban, you know, for the first time in history, the church has come out with direct statements in opposition to his policies and his rhetoric. And so as a member of the church, I can't see how anybody would support him and still say that they support the, you know, the church. And so it's going to be a big numbers here in Arizona. It's going to count a lot. And I think it's going to carry the state for the Biden campaign.
Well, the other thing I think about it is I've got some close friends who are LDS and who have done missions and that kind of thing. And one of the things I've talked to them about is that, you know, in the same way that so many veterans are offended by Trump's inability to grasp caring about something larger than yourself, you know, a community that such a big rite of passage is about going somewhere else in the world and serving something greater than yourself, I can see where people would look at him and say, we're not the same.
Yeah. I mean, he can't see anything other than a personal transaction, which is why he stood at the grave of General Kelly's son and said, I don't get it. What was in it for him? I mean, he doesn't get it. And yeah, you're right. You know, I didn't serve a mission in my church, but, you know, for people who have, he wouldn't understand that. I mean, you can't understand foregoing your career and your college and starting a family to go off and do missionary work as an 18-year-old kid. I mean, so yeah, it's in direct opposition to him. And a lot of people you know, don't have the platform or the courage to come out publicly against him. But I think that, you know, what I feel, and I can only speak from my personal experience, but it's there's overwhelming support in that community for Biden.
Well, we're running out of time, Chris, and I would love to ask you one final question or kind of have you react to a statement even, which is, it sounds to me like one of the scary parts for you about the ideological transition, especially the public nature of it, is that your community around you is so overwhelmingly supportive of Trump. And that, so you both had a physical community that you had to leave in some kind of way, right? Or at least alienate yourself from. And there's an ideological community that you were leaving at the same time. And I was struck by, you know, you say that you were potentially, you know, you potentially want to become a Democrat. But one thing I want to say to you is, even if you didn't, I think one thing that you're underscoring for me and hopefully for our listeners is that it doesn't need to take somebody like you becoming a Democrat for us to welcome you into some kind of community where we can have better conversations and have each other's back and care about each other. You know, you don't have to come all the way that far. As a Democrat, I would love for you to do that, but I don't think you have to, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest reasons that I decided to run for Congress was to restore, you know, the basic decency of being able to disagree with somebody and not question their motives or not question their character or you know, not attack them personally. And that's one of the things that I made a big talking point on the trail was that, you know, this disgusting hyperpartisanship that we see, we can't accomplish anything going the way that we're going now. And at the top of the food chain, the president, you know, he sets that tone. And you know, I think that there's so many Republican members of the Senate and the House that are secretly praying for President Trump to lose and go away so that they can actually get things done for their constituents. And, you know, you're right. I think that the things that I am most passionate about, helping veterans, getting real meaningful criminal justice reform and addiction recovery reform, you know, those are things that the Democrat Party has highlighted as top priorities. And those are things that over the next, you know, part of my life, I want to play a pivotal role and fight for that. And so if I want to be involved in politics, I would love to be the one, you know, the first congressional independent to win a seat. You know, Justin Amash didn't run as an independent when he, but you know what I'm saying, but I don't think that's probably possible. And so, you know, I am open to joining the Democrats. My brother is Kathy Hoffman's communications director in Arizona. She's the superintendent of public education in Arizona, very progressive. And so, you know, I have that outlet and those type of friends that have been supporting me. And so I feel only love coming from that side and inclusion. And I don't feel that from the other side. So, yeah.
I got one last question. Did you ever get to meet John McCain?
No, I never did. I got to spend some time with Jeff Flake, but no, I never got to meet John McCain. You know, I wish I had. And I've got to meet some of his closest advisors and stuff, you know, who were kind of helping me behind the scenes on my campaign. But yeah, he's a big hero of mine for sure.
Well, mine too. And I only ever met him once, but I think he would be very proud of you. Thanks, man, for doing this. I really appreciate it. Tell everybody your podcast again and tell them where they can find it.
Okay, so it's Come This Far with Chris Taylor, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, pretty much any platform that you get your podcasts on. Just search for Come This Far with Chris Taylor.
And give them your social media handles so they can find you and tell you how much they appreciated hearing from you.
So my Twitter is at Taylor, the number 4, Arizona. And then Facebook, it's at Taylor 4, Arizona, F-O-R, Arizona.
Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. Everybody, obviously what we did here is a little bit different than a usual episode. Please feel free to leave a review for us, and you can let us know whether you liked it, whether you'd like it to be any different, that sort of thing. We really appreciate it. But in the meantime, remember, we all have a platform. Make sure to use yours today.